From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the coverage of Hurricane Sandy left several big messes in its wake that required later cleanup. For instance, reports of the death of the Atlantic City boardwalk were, as they say, highly exaggerated.
ABC's Ginger Z in Atlantic City with that story. Boy, Ginger, the storm really wiped that away.
I mean, we could not even get to that boardwalk as of a couple of hours ago, but we just saw some of the first images. And let me tell you, the boardwalk that you and I have walked and so many others, part of it is gone.
It's a piece of boardwalk, but it's not the boardwalk. And that piece had been in disrepair. And frankly, Sandy probably saved the city some money by tossing it into the ocean.
That's John Brennan, who covers sports and gaming for the New Jersey Record.
And then apparently CNN in the early evening went with this again, and that really took it to a whole nother level. So at that point, I posted a blog note saying, let's get the nonsense out of the way. There is no devastation to the Atlantic City tourism district near the casinos.
Brennan was mightily frustrated.
I do think a correction and clarification at the very least would be in order, because there's only one section of boardwalk in Atlantic City that people care about, and that piece is fully intact. A lot of people were misled.
Yeah, there was a lot of that going around in the old media and, of course, in the new media, too.
As Hurricane Sandy made its way up the eastern coast of the country, we saw homes underwater, trees torn from the ground, and tunnels flooding. We also saw massive waves crashing against the Statue of Liberty and sharks swimming through flooded neighborhoods. But those images were fake. Salon senior writer Laura Miller says that the fake photographs circulated during the storms showed the, quote, unreal, real world we now occupy during disasters.
Probably the most widely circulated one was of a sort of swirling, brownish, blackish cloud ready to pounce on the Statue of Liberty.
There was even a picture I saw of a cloud in the shape of an evil kitten threatening the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, someone photoshopped a mad Persian cat's face into the cloud.
Why?
Well, I think that the fake photos fall into different categories. The sort of premature ones I see as less an attempt to sort of say, this is what's happening now, than to say, this is how we all feel right now. They're almost more in the realm of art and commentary than they are in reporting. The irritating thing about that is that then once the real photos start to come in, you're like, is that real?
That's what Farhad Manju calls the Photoshopification of the world. It's not so much that you'll believe stuff that's false, but that you'll disbelieve stuff that's real.
That's very true. Someone on salon staff, we did the photo of the roller coaster in New Jersey sort of collapsing into the waves. And I remember looking at it going, oh, that's so fake. That turned out to be a real photo.
There was one Twitter troll in particular that seemed to have contributed a great deal to the misinformation. What can you tell me about at Comfortably Smug?
That was Shashank Tripathi. He was a hedge fund analyst and a campaign manager for a local Republican candidate. He was tweeting news updates, you know, that the stock exchange was flooded or that Con Ed was going to turn off all of the power in Manhattan. And these, you know, many people took to be real, although if you looked at his whole Twitter feed, you could see that, you know, some of the things that he tweeted were obviously not meant to be taken that seriously. But that's not the way tweets work. Each one is a discrete unit. They get circulated out of context.
His defenses were all about people could have seen that I was lying.
Yes. If you had done your job, you would have been able to see that I was lying or joking or whatever it was he was doing. With certain of these people who go out and trollishly post misinformation, there's a diminishing value to sort of speculating on their mentality. They're outliers. They're just the nasty people in this world, and they just were less visible before the internet.
Let's pick up on this idea. There was a great deal of outrage towards At Comfortably Smug, but you wrote that he was, quote, just one thread in a weave of reality and unreality that swathed everyone who was trying to follow the hurricane, and that complaints about social media trolls like him are historically short-sighted.
Whenever I hear about these bogus, you know, social media rumors, I think of disasters where I was in place. Now, with Sandy, I wasn't even in New York. But for the Loma Prieta earthquake in the late 1980s, I was in San Francisco, and we lost power, and our neighbors plugged a radio into a car battery, and we were hearing these reports that the Bay Bridge had collapsed. And of course, we assumed that that meant that the entire bridge had sort of crumpled into the water and cars going over the edge. You know, we were completely terrified. It was not nearly as catastrophic as we believed. I think that it is for the good that we have all become a lot more skeptical about any kind of media report or photograph that is circulated, not only in social media, but in traditional media, because they never really were all that reliable. The relentless focus and the drive to find something or anything creates a sense sometimes that disasters are more extensive than they really are. The thing that I would be more concerned about is that we haven't really reconciled ourselves to how much of life actually isn't reportable. At the same time that it seems exaggerated, who knows what we aren't aware of because it's not photographed. The fact that we could miss something doesn't really occur to people, partly because we have this belief that everything important is photographed, and that is potentially dangerous.
Laura, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Salon senior writer Laura Miller. Her point about traditional media's far from spotless history bears repeating. They were Comfortably Smug's accomplices because they retweeted his tweets. As Heidi Moore wrote in The Guardian, his claim about the New York Stock Exchange was retweeted nearly 650 times during the height of the storm, often by credible journalists. The reach of that tweet, she wrote, was so powerful that the National Weather Service repeated it, which then allowed it to make its way to the Weather Channel and CNN. Within an hour, the national press was reporting this completely made-up statement as fact.
Those actually skeptical of the false images being spread during Hurricane Sandy had one-stop shopping for verification in a website called Is Twitter Wrong? The site was created by Tom Phillips, an international editor at MSN in London, who spent much of the megastorm debunking fake images from more than 3,000 miles away. Tom, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks very much.
Pictures, of course, don't lie, except they sometimes do. Give me some examples of the visual whoppers that you located.
The one that did the rounds most was a series of pictures supposedly of a shark swimming along the flooded streets of Brigantine, New Jersey.
Which you proved once and for all was not a shark.
Yeah, it was photoshopped. It was tricky to prove, actually, because it's just on the edge of plausibility. It could happen, but it probably didn't.
The very process of getting out the truth has this perverse effect of giving the lie or the error more life. Do you have any way of knowing whether your efforts are yielding more truth or just exactly the opposite?
I know for a fact that the site was seen by tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people that day. I know that the post on The Atlantic, which Alexis Madrigal did, which we ended up collaborating on for a while, I know that was seen by nearly a million people. One of the key things that Alexis did on The Atlantic was he'd overlay on that picture a big, nice, fake or real banner, and would also include information about where the picture came from in text on the picture itself.
So in the event that his tweet got retweeted, at least that would not propagate the misinformation.
And rather than just bluntly saying, yep, this is fake, this is real, guide people through the process of how we'd reach that conclusion, it kind of gives people a toolkit for how to do this stuff themselves, because there's no special secret trick to this. All of the stuff we did was using free, publicly available tools, and an awful lot of it took less than a minute, 30 seconds to actually get done.
How effective were you in correcting bad tweets that were carelessly passed along by CNN and others?
It's often likened to trying to get toothpaste back in a tube once a rumor gets out there and starts spreading. I think it's actually harder than that. It's like trying to stuff an angry cat into a condom. We focused on pictures because we thought that was the place that a lot of the fakes were likely to come. And in the early stages, before landfall, that's what they were. But of course, once landfall happened, most of the hoaxes, misunderstandings, outright lies, they were simple statements. And we were focusing so much on the pictures that I think a lot of those passed us by.
Do you have any thoughts as to what prompts people to pass this stuff on to begin with?
A mixture of honest misunderstandings, jokes that get out of control, and then just plain trolling. I think one of the ways that it happens is people see a picture, they don't understand the context of it. A newspaper's used a stock picture to illustrate a story about the upcoming storm. You know, a blog has just done an image search to illustrate, you know, their piece about something. People don't realize that that's what it is, and they go, oh my God, that's the thing. And then they take it away from that original context and they share it, and all of a sudden, it's got a life of its own. The other one is jokes that get out of control. There was one particularly staggering image, which I honestly didn't think anybody believed was real until I saw enough tweets of people going, oh my God, this is terrifying, which was the picture of the Statue of Liberty being submerged by a wall of water. Now, there was no sort of clever technological wizardry needed to disprove that. You just needed to remember what happened in the film The Day After Tomorrow. It was in the trailer, for goodness sake. That was clearly created as a joke, except a lot of people didn't get the joke. Much the same, the sharks on the street in Brigantine, New Jersey, the guy who created those in the first place, they were on his Facebook and you could see the conversation happening around them. And his friends in the comments are going, yeah, nice Photoshop skills. You nearly had me there. Well done. And once again, that was a joke that got taken out of context. Then there are people who are doing it because they want to feel superior. They want to show, oh, look how gullible everybody is. And some people are just sociopaths. But, you know, we knew that.
Tom, thank you so much.
Hey, it's been a pleasure.
Tom Phillips is an international editor at MSN in London and in his free time, founder of the Is Twitter Wrong Tumblr.
Coming up, an American icon quits newspapers. You may know him as Clark Kent.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's the week before the election, and there seems to be two prevailing views about what will happen on Tuesday, but they don't break down along party lines. One camp asserts that President Obama will most likely win re-election. That camp includes 538's Nate Silver, who told us Thursday afternoon that there's a 79% chance of an Obama win, a number that he has since revised upward. Also in Silver's camp, right-leaning journalists like the Washington Examiner's Timothy Carney, who wrote a piece Thursday titled, "Why I Think Obama Will Win in Detail." But there's another camp. Poll skeptics who still think it's a toss-up. Joe Klein of Time magazine is one. He wrote a column simply titled, "I Don't Know." The left-leaning blog Truthout is also skeptical, as is former Republican congressman, now MSNBC host, Joe Scarborough.
Nate Silver says this is a 73.6% chance that the president's going to win. Nobody in that campaign thinks they have a 73. Oh. They think they have a 50.1% chance of winning. Anybody that thinks that this race is anything but a toss-up right now is such an ideologue. They should be kept away from typewriters, computers, laptops, and microphones for the next 10 days because they're jokes.
Nate Silver, you are so confident in your predictions. You challenged Joe Scarborough to a $1,000 bet that Obama would win.
It's pretty simple. Obama leads in the polls in states like Ohio, Iowa, Wisconsin. That would suffice to give him 270 electoral votes. Therefore, he's the favorite. If you're a pundit and you're someone who's paid to render your opinion and you care about being accurate, I think the argument is stronger both in an intuitive way and based on this complex formula that we have for Obama based on swing state polls. But I think Joe is ducking the question, which kind of lets you know that he's more of an entertainer than someone who's really doing any kind of analysis or...
Ooh,
or,
okay. Yeah.
Look at all the cases in the past since 1968 where candidates 2 or 3 points ahead in a swing state like Ohio, as Obama is now, in the average of polls. And how often did he win? So you count those as wins. How often did he lose? You count those as losses. And then you have a percentage score. That's really all we're doing.
Okay. Truth Out points out that few people answer telephone polls. Only 9% of people do. And that those weirdos certainly aren't representative of the average voter.
Oh, sure. And look, there are two contradictory kind of trends here. On the one hand, if you just look at how well have the polls actually done, they've been getting better. So 2004, they nailed the election, 2008. On the other hand, if you look at how many people are actually answering these calls, then it's fewer and fewer people. So which of those will prevail on Tuesday, we're not sure. We assume the polls could miss, but if they're biased, it could be either way.
How does it feel to be a legend in your own time?
It's been very odd to have 538 itself be a story. And I think that itself kind of tells you a little bit about maybe where people's priorities are misplaced. You know, people sometimes say, oh, you know, people focus too much on the polls to begin with, right? But when you then focus on someone who builds statistical models based on the polls, you're one level further removed away from anything that really affects the average American in any obvious way.
I don't know. I think that you yourself, if you weren't affecting this false modesty right now, would concede that people following your meta poll would be closer than people who are trying to follow individual polls.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm less modest about, though. I think we have a better way of doing things. And the reason I got into this is because I found the horse race coverage extremely vapid, right? Where a lot of it was just kind of recycling quotes from the campaigns and talking in cliches that didn't really hold up to scrutiny. And I had seen in baseball, a field I was in before covering politics, how you had kind of the Moneyball revolution seeped its way into kind of journalism first and then inside the game. Politics is kind of the reverse almost, where campaigns themselves are quite data-driven, but I think the people who cover them are not as much. They're always more allured by what they think is the quote-unquote narrative, what I think, frankly, is the spin.
You're kind of like the Jonah Hill character of politics.
I've gotten that comparison more than the Brad Pitt comparison, unfortunately.
Sorry. At some point, you're going to make a high certainty prediction about something high profile, like maybe a presidential election, and it'll break the other way. It won't even necessarily mean that you were wrong. In this election, for instance, by your numbers, if you ran a scenario 10 times, Romney would win at least twice.
I will stand here or sit here right now and guarantee you we're going to be wrong sooner or later. What's different is that we tell you how likely we are to be wrong and how often. I mean, the irony here is that in my book, The Signal and the Noise, I talk a lot about how do we think about uncertainty and how do we measure uncertainty. But that's something that even people who are versed in statistics aren't very good at doing. And certainly, I think pundits and reporters aren't very good at doing, where everything has to be either a 50-50, we can't weigh in, or it's, oh, this is certain, and usually the truth is somewhere between 0 and 100.
But if Tuesday is one of those times where Romney wins, is your goose cooked? Will you ever work in this town again?
I mean, not if some of the bigger hacks in the media establishment get their way.
But those hacks have an even lower record of probability, we've noted on this program, than you have by far.
Well, so look, I think people are competitive, right? And a lot of what I do implicitly critiques the horse race coverage. We've had, I should say, a very steady forecast. We had all 50 states the same when we launched the model in June. We know which states have more Republicans than Democrats. We know it's going to be a close election based on the economy, and it's maybe not all that complicated. But people want to pretend that someone wins the day, and there are all these ups and downs, and momentum, and the roller coaster, and game change, and all these terms that are used are basically BS. And when someone calls them on that and asks them to provide their facts and to defend their analysis, and they can't do it, they become very, very defensive. And they want to shoot the messenger.
Don't hit me, Nate.
Not you. Not you. You have this show, this program has self-awareness.
Nate Silver, blogs at 538, and you can find him on the New York Times website. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
With ad revenue and circulation continuing to decline for print newspapers, many are experimenting with present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Present and future business models to monetize the newspaper industry.
But earlier this month, the Seattle Times Company made the decision to gin up ad revenue by publishing political ads on its own dime in its own pages. So readers found a full-page ad depicting a hand holding scissors ready to cut the rope in a tug-of-war, with the caption, "Rob McKenna's new direction for Washington, cut partisan gridlock." McKenna is the Republican candidate for governor in Washington. Readers also saw an ad supporting a referendum that would legalize gay marriage. The ads cost the Times Company about $75,000 each, and both are part of a campaign by the Times Company to promote political advertising in newspapers, as in not on TV. The Times hoped to shield itself from charges of partisanship by promoting both a largely Democratic issue and a Republican candidate. Eli Sanders writes for the Seattle alt-weekly The Stranger. Eli, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, if I understand this right, the Seattle Times is doing this to demonstrate the power of newspapers in political advertising, a marketplace long since ceded to local TV. They want some of that revenue back, right?
Yes, and I understand their frustration. It's true. The television stations in Seattle make millions of dollars from political advertising each campaign season, and as the Seattle Times is saying, they don't. Yet the TV stations largely piggyback on the work that the Seattle Times does in terms of political coverage.
The Times Company made a point of seeming impartial in this experiment by buying one set of ads in its own paper for a Republican candidate and another set of ads in its paper for a ballot proposition more or less corresponding with the Democratic demographic. Do you think anyone has noticed that decision?
No, it has largely failed as an argument here in Seattle and among the Times readership and people who follow the paper closely, not to mention among the newspaper's staff.
Tell me about the petition.
The petition was generated by employees of the Seattle Times and the news gathering side who were outraged about this and really demoralized, and they felt that they had to do something. And so more than 100 of them signed this letter to the publisher that says, "You are hurting our credibility with this. This makes our job harder."
Strictly speaking, there's nothing unethical or even irrational about this so-called experiment. It carries on a tradition of the owners of the newspaper behaving absolutely independently of the newsroom and vice versa. But from a public relations point of view,
it's really a problem for their brand. And this is where I actually am not sure whether it's a rational business decision. There's three possible scenarios here. All of them are worrying. One is that the people who were running the company thought this was an incredibly smart business decision and did not foresee this backlash. Another is that they knew there would be a backlash, but they were willing to risk it on the possibility that they would get more revenue from political ads. And another possibility is that the people at the company actually believed that they could prove what they are setting out to prove and then make more money this way.
Yeah, so let me ask you about that third possibility, because this is not a scientific experiment. If McKenna wins and referendum 74 wins, does that mean that newspapers are a superior medium for political advertising? If one prevails and the other does not, what have we learned?
Exactly. I mean, this is a very high-risk gamble. What if both of them do lose? They have damaged their credibility, and I don't know how they're going to credibly argue that their print ads do anything.
Eli, the Seattle Times Company declined to appear on the program. However, one of its executives, Alan Fisco, did appear on the Seattle public radio station, KUOW, and had this to say.
Our goal is hopefully to make sure that we get on the radar of those political strategists. And frankly, we won't know whether this is successful until next year and in coming years, when we hope and expect that this will result in greater revenues to our newspaper.
I believe that was the last public comment on the whole brouhaha. When erratic decisions are made, history shows that the ideas frequently began at the very, very top. I mean, here's a scenario I can imagine. Frank Blethyn, the owner and publisher, saying, here's this a great idea I have for building up the political category. See, we give away ads, and then when these guys win, then, you know, the next cycle we just clean up. And the advertising manager goes, yeah, I don't know, Frank. There's some risk attached to that. No, this is a great idea. Well, Frank, we've got our editorial independence to consider. No, this is – yeah. So my question for you is, does this have Blethyn's fingerprints all over it?
You know, I don't know. And this is part of the problem that the Times Company's lack of engagement with people who want to write about this now is allowing people like you and me to sit here and spin out scenarios where we're talking in the voice of Frank Blethyn. I've been doing the same thing, but they only say that this originated on the advertising side of the paper.
Well, it's a weird one. On this week's show, this is the story that you can definitely brand the, you know, the three-headed goat. Eli, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Eli Sanders is an associate editor for the Seattle Alt-Weekly, The Stranger.
Oh my, whatever happened to the unambiguous beacon of truth that was once the daily paper? It never was, that's what. Not in reality, and not even in the imagination. Consider Clark Kent, that mild-mannered moonlighting reporter for the Daily Planet. He regularly covers a public figure with whom he has an intimacy that constitutes a massive conflict of interest. In the latest issue of the Superman comic books, Clark quits his job as a reporter for the Daily Planet, and the writers say he'll become a blogger. Larry Tye is the author of Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero. Welcome back to the show, Larry.
Great to be back with you, Brooke.
So this isn't the first time that Superman quit the Daily Planet, is it?
It's actually the third time that he quit, and each time he did it with a flair. In the 1970s, when TV looked like it could displace our daily newspaper, Superman quit and went to work at a company that had bought the Daily Planet called Galaxy Broadcasting. 20 years later, he did it again, only this time his arch enemy Lex Luthor decided the way to shut up Clark Kent was to buy his newspaper. He fired Superman, and he was out on the street. And now this time, he does it saying that daily journalism had changed. Facts had been replaced by opinions. Information was being replaced by entertainment. Reporters, he said, had become stenographers.
And he goes on, I am not the only one who believes in the power of the press, the fact that we need to stand up for truth, for justice, and yeah, I'm not ashamed to say, the American way. And then he tries to lead a mutiny, but only one reporter, a very sexy-looking fashion writer, follows him out the door.
Yes, very sad.
You say that reporting is just about the perfect job for an alien from another planet who wants to understand human behavior.
It was the perfect outlet, I think, for them to try to humanize their superhero. Superman differed from Batman and Spider-Man in one critical way. While with them, the real characters were Bruce Wayne and Peter Parker, with Superman, the real character was this alien from outer space. And what better way to humanize this human part of him than to have him out there in the street with humanity, watching when people were being beaten up, watching when anything was happening that was newsworthy.
But he wasn't that great of a reporter to begin with, was he?
He was actually a miserable reporter to begin with, being beat on every story by Lois Lane. And that was an inspiration to young women who were coming up in journalism, and it was pretty sad if Clark Kent was your role model.
Someone on Twitter named Tom Spurgeon, who runs the website comicsreporter.com, wrote a tweet that said, quote, Clark Kent should take really well to blogging, considering he writes mostly about himself without fully disclosing the fact.
I mean, I love it.
It's a good point. I mean, does he really have the moral high ground here?
If all he's going to do is report on Superman's exploits, he can do it as a blogger, and it's the perfect forum for him to do it. But if he's going to be the reporter that he's been, then he's got to do more than sit at his computer as a blogger.
What do you mean by that?
He didn't just sit at his desk at the paper. He was on the scene so that Superman could be on the scene. And I hope Clark Kent continues to do that and realize that that's one of the things that's made him fun and made him a role model for reporters like me.
Seriously? Next year is Superman's 75th anniversary. Should we see his rejection of the print medium as a trope in the next movie?
Warner Brothers will be releasing next June, the month of Superman's 75th birthday, a movie called The Man of Steel. And I think they may be trying to figure out just what role as a reporter Superman ought to be playing. And depending on the reaction to this leaving the Daily Planet, they may decide based on that just where to position Clark Kent in terms of his work in the movie.
What's your favorite Superman theme?
So my favorite musical theme was the one that John Williams wrote for the Christopher Reeve 1978 Superman the movie. I thought it was brilliant. Do you remember that one?
Yes, I do.
Yes.
Although I found that one that really kept babies from crying was the TV theme. Do-do-do, do-do-do-do, 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 do-do-do-do.
You remember the show?
Absolutely.
I was an enormous fan of George Reeves. I loved when the crooks would fire the gun at him and bullets would bounce off of him, and then they'd get frustrated and they'd throw the gun at him and he would duck.
Larry, thanks again.
Thank you.
Larry Tye is the author of Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero.
Coming up, why our internet is so slow.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org, the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org, and the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence, at theScanFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Since Twitter-propagated information can sometimes be as polluted as an overflowing East River, we'll consider a few tips for healthy consumption. OTM's PJ Vogt gorged on Twitter all through the emergency, and he stayed relatively, for him, sane. PJ?
Hey, Bob. So yeah, some people said to me that for them, Twitter was just a useless lie factory during the storm. And to them, I would say that Twitter is only as useful as the people that you choose to follow. So like in an emergency, you probably want to first pick the relevant institutions. I followed Con Ed, which is the big electric utility in New York, and they were incredibly active during the storm. They were incredibly active during the storm on Twitter. One of my friends is a reporter. She spent the better part of a day trying to get a phone call from them about what neighborhoods were going to lose power. I tweeted at them, and 5 minutes later, they were like, oh, Brighton Beach, Brooklyn. Similarly, the mayor's office, the governor's office, these places, I don't know if it's a New York-specific thing or what, but they were a great source for the most up-to-date information.
So your Twitter stream was just city agencies?
No. If you think of Twitter as like a meal, the official sources are the nutritious parts, like the vegetables. The side dishes are your journalists and your experts. So this time during the storm, one of the guys that I was following pretty closely was the Wall Street Journal's, I think he's their weather correspondent, Eric Holthouse. He just knew what was going on and could explain everything as it happened. But the other thing about Twitter is that people end up being these sort of pop-up clearinghouses about information. So there's this guy, Joseph Weisenthal, the deputy editor of Business Insider. Normally the guy mostly tweets jobs numbers, but he's in New York, so he was giving out good information as he got it. And he was another person who, for me, just happened to be very reliable. And then the other thing is that when you're using Twitter, you want to be a fair weather friend. As soon as someone stops being useful to you, they give you wrong information, they retweet a lot of bad information, you just drop them.
So in general, this experience, this total Twitter immersion during Sandy, did it yield any surprises, disappointments, revelations, heartbreak?
This is a little embarrassing because I think a lot of people knew this already. But for me, using it during the storm was the first time I'd understood the sense of community that people get specifically from this platform. At this one point, my street flooded with waist-high water and a dumpster just floated past me. And I took a picture of it and I tweeted it out and I was just expressing something. I didn't really know who I was talking to. And over the next 20 minutes, I got, I think, like 10 to 20 messages from people asking me follow-up questions, telling me to be safe. They were people that I'd never met, and they were my neighbors.
Oh, I'm a little, I'm verklempt.
I just wanted to make you feel something, Bob.
Am I not but flesh and blood, PJ? Just a man. I'm glad you survived. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bob.
PJ Vogt is a producer for On the Media. And on the subject of bad information, there is yet one more OTM voice to be heard from. Jamie?
Hi. I'm interim senior producer of On the Media, Jamie York. A few weeks ago, something was said during our show that I would like to take personal responsibility for. And before we get to the mistake itself, I have to admit, it was not the first time it happened. And each time, well, twice, I vowed never again. This time, though, I really mean it. While promoting our Media Scrutiny Theater series, in which silhouettes of Bob and Brooke comment on and mock campaign ads, to great effect, I might add, I asked Brooke to provide a web address. She agreed, reluctantly, to say what I asked her to say.
You'll find it at onthemedia.org/blogs/MST.
You've no doubt caught the rookie mistake. Man, are you not alone. We got some very nice, but stern emails taking us to task for making such a reckless error. David Cole from something called Twitter wrote, quote, Brooke Gladstone is still saying backslash, which always makes me wince. It's just slash. What is that, a smiley face? Smiley face. Michael wrote, backslash may be fun to say, but it's used in Windows DOS file addresses, not web addresses. Leah from Brooklyn said, you're certainly not the first person I've heard misread a slash in a URL, but you are the smartest. I know you can do better. David, Michael, Sue, and the 4.5 other people who, on my advice, broke the internet, I'm sorry. Brooke is just as smart as she ever was. She knows good fun from bad fun. She'll keep doing better and better and better. I will try to get my head back in the game and rep a generation born after 1970. Never again. Never again.
But even though I initially objected, I did say it, and I'm supposed to catch stuff like that, so I should definitely share in the ensuing abuse. That said, if you'd like to check out those Media Scrutiny Theater clips, they're at small black circle, on the media, smallblackcircle.org/blogs/MST. A lie can go halfway around the world before the truth gets its pants on. But actually, doesn't that depend on the speed of your internet connection? The Commerce Department reports that over 100 million Americans do not have high-speed internet at home, largely because of high costs and the lack of available infrastructure. The United States once led the world in internet speed and infrastructure. Now, according to one estimate, it ranks at about 29. And David K. Johnston, journalist and author of The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, says that the government sits passively back as the cost of cable soars and telephone companies rake in hundreds of billions of dollars because they promise to upgrade their systems from low-speed copper wire to high-speed fiber optic. But the companies haven't been under any pressure to deliver it.
And instead, the companies diverted that money and built us the cell telephone network. Each of these companies has looked at how to maximize its profits. And if they think they can make more money by cross-marketing between Verizon and Comcast instead of laying down fiber optic, they're going to do that.
What you're saying is that Verizon can provide its service on Comcast's infrastructure. It doesn't cost them nearly as much as building their own, but they can still raise prices.
Cartels inherently have an upward pressure on prices. That's the reason that we have antitrust laws, which we're ignoring in these cases. The real competition that's going on in the country is coming from municipal systems, places like Chattanooga, Tennessee, Lafayette, Louisiana, that have built their own municipal high-quality internet systems. And so what has the response been of the telecommunications companies? Let's get laws passed at the state level that either prohibit municipal systems or severely restrict them so we can continue to jack up prices, provide low-quality services, and create a cartel, the emerging AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, Cox, Time Warner cartel.
There have been publicly funded systems that compete with private internet, but not without a great deal of difficulty. You cite the case of Glasgow, Kentucky, as an example of how things can work, but the kinds of extraordinary challenges they face getting off the ground.
The Progress and Freedom Foundation, which was actually a front group for the telecommunications industry created by Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker of the House, worked together with the local monopoly provider, then called Telescripts, to try and defeat construction of the system in Glasgow. They tried to run up legal bills, published articles saying this is inherently an inefficient and bad idea, government can't do this well. They did everything they could to block this system. Well, once the system got in place, lo and behold, it paid for itself and made money for the city. It was dramatically better, faster than the existing system at much lower cost.
So how hard would it be to replicate the experience of Glasgow, Kentucky?
A number of other communities have done what Glasgow has done. Those communities that have built their own systems generally charge much lower prices, provide much, much better and more reliable service, and in many cases, they generate a profit that helps hold down property taxes in those communities.
David, are you saying that the public option is always the better option? I mean, governments have been known to misuse public funds.
Sure, and so have corporations. You don't hear about it when corporations do it because they don't have to make the disclosures that your local city government does. But no, I'm not arguing that we shouldn't necessarily have corporate systems. What I'm saying is we need to have a set of rules that say what we need is universal high-speed access. We need to have the best internet in the world if we're going to compete in the 21st century economy so that we don't end up as we are now with an internet not up to the standards of places like Ukraine, Moldavia, Lithuania.
So what if we don't have as good an internet system as Moldavia?
You know, about a third of our economy comes from advances in physics in the early 20th century. Einstein, back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have today things like geo-positioning satellites and cell phones and the algorithms that allow this broadcast to go all over the country. If we don't have a first-rate internet, there are services that will never be invented here. You have to have the underlying structures if you're going to have economic growth.
You're saying that we should regard the internet as a public utility, as a public service, shepherded to some degree by the government. But isn't that anathema to roughly half the country?
You know, Brooke, I teach the history of business regulation from Hammurabi to today in the law school and the graduate business school at Syracuse. And what a lot of Americans believe about business has no historical reference. It is not consistent with the practices of the founders at the time this country was started. It is instead an ideology promoted by economists that on paper looks beautiful, but in the real world is not how things work out. We need to have public policies that recognize that the internet is the key to economic growth in the 21st century, and that the purpose of our government is not to funnel public resources to promote that of a handful of companies, notably Verizon and AT&T, but to promote, as our Constitution says in its preamble, the general welfare, to make the country better off.
So to paraphrase an old expression about business, what's good for General Motors isn't necessarily good for America?
Exactly.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
David K. Johnston is the author of The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind.
The 3D printer is one of those pieces of technology that seems downright Jetsonian. Get on the internet, download a schematic for an object, and using a 3D printer, you can print out the object itself.
People have printed in plastic objects as varied as clocks, prosthetics, and bikinis. If Cody Wilson has his way, soon they'll be printing guns as well. Wilson is a law student at the University of Texas, Austin, and the head of Defense Distributed, an open-source group working on a schematic for a plastic pistol, not a toy, that would be available to anyone. Wilson says he's not worried that his plastic guns will be that attractive to criminals, since, he says, they currently have easy access to much more dangerous weapons, like the semi-automatic AR-15 assault rifle or the semi-automatic Tech-9 pistol.
Criminals and gangs already have access to the most lethal weapons out there, the military-grade weapons. I'm not concerned about this flimsy technology anytime soon, you know, opening some new era of open violence on the streets or anything. It's just not there. I am optimistic that really 3D manufacturing is here to stay. Yes, a great number of terrible things would be possible in this future, but also a great number of extraordinary things.
To take the question to the extreme, if you can do in your home using technology the kinds of things for which there is no legitimate consumer use, let's just say weapons-grade anthrax, you nonetheless have no objection to it?
I think a civil libertarian would say, why criminalize the possession of something or the creation of something in itself? It isn't that weapons-grade anthrax is evil in and of itself. It's what you could do with that weapons-grade anthrax. And so the educated civil libertarian would say you could only punish the use of that anthrax for criminal purposes, not its creation or possession. You know, and you use the word legitimate. Legitimate's a scary word. Legitimate to whom? Who makes the rules of legitimacy?
That's a fetching argument, but I wouldn't present it to somebody who has lost a loved one to a burglarized gun. The very existence of dangerous things is in and of itself dangerous, is it not?
I'm not sure that you can say there are quote-unquote dangerous things. I don't know. It seems to me a gun is a very safe thing. Very low rates of failure, designed to do what they're intended to do, you know. I think we're dancing around things that are more emotional in nature than anything else. And I'd know. I would never walk up to some victim or some family member of someone slain by a gun and say, well, you know, better that we have these rights. But at the same time, we all recognize the respect of civil liberties, even though we must suffer some social cost. And gun rights are no exception to this.
Do you not run a very high risk of seeing them distributed in exactly the place where you, as a citizen, do not wish to see them?
Yeah, I think you run that risk. I mean, liberty is risky, right? But let's take your extreme case. Let's imagine a future where I can immediately print out a Tech-9 unserialized and it works like a charm. Yes, you risk some very scary things happening. But I don't know. I just do not see the argument that this is something that must be stopped. And in fact, how could you stop it?
A lot of people in discussing distributed weapons will immediately go to the terrorism possibility, right? That terrorists get a hold of this capacity and start smuggling plastic guns onto airplanes with God knows what consequences. It's not a difficult scenario to envision. But you can one-up that scenario. Tell me about your Islamic banking project.
Well, right now, I'm studying just the principles of retail Islamic banking. You know, there's a rich history there, a multi-century history of not charging interest. How could we use the principles of virtual communities online, like reputation and these other things, to enable pseudonymous or anonymous parties to engage in commerce with each other and borrow and lend interest-free bitcoins in a way that would be sustainable? Basically, bitcoin banking, right? A people's bank of bitcoin, but it's interest-free. It's designed to compete with the financial capitalists.
If this were to come to pass, it would arguably be an enabler on a grand scale for financing terrorism.
Right. It's just like the gun argument. Well, you're allowing terrorists to print guns. Well, yes, but you're also allowing people the disintermediated possibility of manufacturing things for themselves and planning their own futures and doing what they will. There are potentially bad consequences to something like this. But again, are we going to say, well, because this right can be abused, we should take it away? No, I think no one's a consequentialist when it comes to things like the First Amendment, you know, the Fourth Amendment, the Ninth Amendment, the Tenth Amendment. You know, so why is the Second Amendment an exception? We all believe in, I think, better 10 guilty men go free than one innocent man be punished. But we must honor certain liberties and allow certain bad things to happen in the interest of protecting the innocent and respecting and honoring civil liberties.
You know how Jim Fix, the runner and cardiovascular guru, died of a heart attack, and the owner of Segway segwayed himself right over a cliff? Do you worry about the irony of the universe leading you to be shot by a plastic gun?
I don't worry about it, but I think it's a strong possibility. Nick Bilton at the New York Times asked me the very same thing. Aren't you worried that someone's going to, you know, print one of these out and shoot you to make some point? Well, yeah, it's probably going to happen, right? But it'll be some progressive, some frustrated progressive who thinks that I ruined the world by, you know, disabling his nanny state. So, well, fine. Perhaps I have to suffer a death, but it only makes their cause look more futile.
Well, I'm just saying that I was at the movies the whole evening, and that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Cody, thank you very, very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Cody Wilson is the founder of Defense Distributed, creator of the Wiki Weapons Project. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Julia Barton, with more help from Lita Martinez and Ariel Stuhlberg. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts and read our fabulous blog at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.